Hello and welcome to Railway Mania. Now, this episode's a bit of a techie one. It's on the various types of articulated locomotives developed over the years, where those ideas came from, and their pros and cons. I need to start this with an apology. This story involves quite a few Welsh names, and I just know I'm not going to get the pronunciation right, so I am sorry in advance to all my Welsh friends out there. I think the best place to start is, what is an articulated locomotive and why do we need them? I think if George Stephenson or Isambard Kingdom Brunel had their way, then all railways would be arrow straight and perfectly flat, because these are the ideal conditions for locomotives, which rely on a steel wheel gripping a steel rail. Next time you look at a train, take a note of just how small the contact area between the wheel and the rail is. It's tiny. It's not like a car or a tank, which spreads its weight out over quite a large contact patch. It's a very small area of steel touching another very small area of steel. On a locomotive, if you want more grip, you can increase the weight of the loco, but that puts a lot of strain on the track, the bridges and the structures and everything else. Alternatively, you can add more driving wheels because that increases the contact area and therefore the likelihood of getting grip. If you add more carrying wheels, then you do spread the load over a wider area, but you can't make use of that load. It's being wasted. So increasing the weight and adding more driving wheels is a neat solution because it spreads the load over a wider area and each wheel gets the same amount of adhesion as before because it's a driven wheel. The issue with this is that it makes the loco much longer and it's less likely to be able to go around corners safely. In America, the Union Pacific Railroad had one class of locomotive that had 12 coupled driving wheels, so that's 6 axles. And in Russia, there was once this ridiculous 414-4 engine, that's 14 driving wheels. And it was a complete failure. It couldn't stay on the track long enough to be of any use. Straight and level track is expensive because the world is bumpy and there may be something like a big mountain range in the way. Tunnels and viaducts cost a lot of money, and sadly during the 1800s they cost a lot of human life to build. So here you see the problem. A railway that bends to go around, over, and under obstacles is cheaper to build, but you need locomotives with plenty of adhesion to pull trains up and down those inclines. Locos with more wheels have more adhesion, but because they have more wheels, they are longer and can't get around the corners. Enter the articulated locomotive. This design bends to follow the line of the railway. Most often, the driving wheels are split into groups or units which swivel. So the fixed wheelbase length is quite short, even if the total length of the locomotive is very long. Take a look at most diesel and electric locomotives these days. They operate on bogies, and that is also an articulated locomotive. Making a steam loco bend is a bit more complex. Many differing approaches have been tried over the years. The Mayer and the Fairlie were developed almost at the same time. In the 1860s, the basic Stephenson type locomotive had been established. In 1861, Jean-Jacques Mayer, a French engineer, patented a design for an articulated locomotive. Now, Mayer's idea was to use two drive units on bogies mounted directly underneath the locomotive superstructure. Both of these bogies could swivel, meaning that the locomotive would get maximum traction with all the weight over the driving wheels. The top half of the loco looks much like a conventional one. Early locomotives built to this design usually had both sets of cylinders positioned towards the centre of the loco. This gives the odd impression that someone's not read the instructions in the kit properly and has assembled it incorrectly. The first of this type was constructed in 1868 for a French company. The design was most popular in continental Europe, particularly the mountainous narrow gauge lines in Saxony. And in fact, in Saxony these days, there are a couple still preserved and at work. These lines sprang up in the 1880s following a government instruction that every citizen had to live within 1 hour's walk of a railway. Various designs of loco were tried, but nothing was satisfactory until the Mayers were introduced in the 1890s, following the Royal Saxon State Railway buying some standard gauge examples. The Saxon Mayers usually used compounding using non-superheated steam. And compounding is where you use the steam twice. You use it firstly in high-pressure cylinders and then you pass it through to the low-pressure cylinders. The large class of IVK locos that resulted were very popular due to their low axle loading. As late as 1945, there were still 57 examples at work, although the ravages of wartime use had taken their toll. Stunningly, 22 new locos were built to the same 70-year-old design in the 1960s to replace the worn-out ones. Hey, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. The disadvantage of a Mayer is that because the drive bogie has to be directly under the boiler, you can't fit a nice deep firebox in, so the steaming capacity is limited, where the firebox would normally go is taken up by the drive bogie, which has to move back and forth. Over the years, there are a few attempts to solve this. the British manufacturer Kitson adapted the design to the Kitsonmayr. And by moving the drive bogies further apart, they often stuck out the front and the back of the loco, they were able to drop a nice big firebox into the gap between the bogies. This allowed the size and the power of the loco to increase, as well as more coal and water storage at the back. And one funny feature of a lot of Kitsonmayrs is they often had two chimneys, one in the normal place and one at the back, which would stick up out of the coal bunker. The most extensive users of this type were the railways in South America, particularly Chile. The incredible Transandine Railway used Kitsonmayrs that were also fitted to climb steep gradients using the rack system. One of the locos was kept in working order for snow clearance purposes well into the 1970s. There's still a few dotted around, including several large tank loco types preserved in Chile, and a couple of rusty skeletons lie in the train graveyard in Bolivia, where students take photos of them whilst travelling on their gapyar. One of the non-rack-fitted Chilean examples met a rather unpleasant demise. The large side tanks were known to cause the loco to become unstable in curves. This unfortunate loco derailed, rolled over, and went over the mountainside. In Colombia, there were several examples at work on the 3-foot gauge Girardo Railway. One of these designs was a 2662 tank locomotive that was capable of 40,000 pounds of tractive effort, which is more than a BR Standard 9F from a 3-foot gauge loco. Later, Bagnall, another British manufacturer, attempted to solve the Mayr problem by using a different type of boiler with a round firebox, similar to those used in small steamboats. The last one of these was called Monarch, which was built in 1953 and is now preserved on the Welshpool and Llanfair Railway. Rather tellingly, it's now a static exhibit because the odd firebox proved challenging for the crew to use and it struggled with the heavy gradients. It was also criticised for being very slow to raise steam. This, along with the increased maintenance cost, might explain why the owners, Bowater's Paper Mills, were so eager to sell it despite it being their newest engine. It worked in industry for less than 15 years. Monarch was in fact the final narrow-gauge steam locomotive built for British industrial use, so it's quite significant in preservation. In 1954, the year after Monarch was built, Bagnall sent a survey team out to South Africa, where the other members of this type were at work in industry. The report was largely unfavourable. The rugged and harsh conditions that the locos had to work in was not good for articulated locomotives, which demand a higher level of maintenance. One of the locos had been abandoned already, unserviceable after only 12 years' use. It was criticised for being expensive to run, weak on power, and having a proneness for priming. Priming is an interesting subject, and I'd like to cover what it is in a future episode. Other locos had trouble with the Bagnall boiler, with engineers having to weld the tubes in because they'd overexpanded. The flexible steam joints and pipes would actually hit the brake gear when the loco rounded a corner. One of the locos was said to take 16 hours to raise steam. I suspect that a loco with a deeper firebox would be able to draw more air through the fire and raise steam more quickly. The Mayr design didn't really catch on in the UK despite Kitson and Bagnall's improvements, and most of those that were built here were for the export market. I want to end the Mayr portion of this episode on a high note, so in an unusual tale, one railway high up in the Alps saw steam come to the rescue of electric trains. The Bernina Railway has incredibly steep gradients and usually uses electric traction, but the light rail cars proved unable to deal with bigger snowdrifts, even when fitted with ploughs. To combat the problem and to keep the lines clear, Swiss Locomotive Works built a large rotary snow plough. Rather than a blade at the front to plough through snow in the conventional sense, the rotary design has a huge rotating set of blades at the front, almost the full width and height of a train. It looks a bit like someone's grafted on a set of aeroplane propellers to the front of a wooden-bodied tram engine. The steam-powered propellers chop up the snowdrifts and fling the snow away from the track. The designers had to fulfil the criteria of it being self-propelled, articulated, have enough power to rotate the blades, and a low axle loading, so they settled on the Mayr type. There were two built, one in 1910 and one in 1912, but over 100 years later, the original is still in use, doing the job it was built for. Almost at the same time, there was a rival design under development. Robert Francis Fairley, a Scottish engineer, patented his own design for an articulated loco in 1864 and constructed his first prototype just a year later. So he patented it after Mayr, but he actually built his first loco before him. Fairley reasoned that the answer was a double-ended loco. This would mean that it would not have to be turned around at the end of every journey, and none of the weight would be wasted on a tender. Every bit of weight was over the driving wheels and contributing to adhesion. Fairley's design looks like two tank locos stuck back to back. He wasn't the first to try this style, it had appeared more than 10 years earlier, but he did make it work. Fairley's first two prototypes were standard gauge. On these locos, there were two boilers sharing a single firebox in the middle. But what happened was that one boiler would steal all the heat for itself, meaning that the other would have trouble steaming. For the third prototype, Fairley separated the fireboxes. Like Mayer, Fairley used two power bogies, one under each end of the loco. He would face his outwards. And again, this would mean that the maximum fixed wheelbase was only the size of the power bogie. The great advantage of Fairley's patent was that having the firebox in the middle of the loco allowed a much bigger one to be used than on the Mayer. But there were several issues with the Fairley. Most importantly, you can only carry a limited amount of fuel on board. The fact that the crew are in the middle means that you can't just add a bigger tender when you want more fuel. The fireman has to be able to physically reach the coal. Fairleys that were used in Mexico tended to use oil firing, which works better as it can be delivered through pipes. And in preservation days, the Fasinio Railway's Fairleys also ran on oil until it became more expensive than coal. The second issue was to do with bogies themselves, and this was a problem with Mayers as well. Now, because the bogies swivel, it's hard to get a reliable joint on the main steam pipe that supplies the cylinders. At first, they tried a coiled copper tube, but these would fracture over time. The problem with the steam joint was eventually solved by using a ball and socket type fitting. Fairley's third loco, called Little Wonder, was used intensively for 13 years, but it had rather uneven balancing and pretty much shook itself to pieces. Later Fairleys had balancing weights on the back of the power bogies to counterbalance the weight of the cylinders. They rode a lot better, much more smoothly. Unfortunately, there's no evidence to suggest that David Bowie wrote his song Little Wonder about the double Fairley locomotive. In Britain, the biggest user was the Festiniog Railway in North Wales, which served as the testbed and proving ground for the design. In fact, Fairley was so grateful to the Festiniog for their help that he granted them an in-perpetuity license to use his patent, and many Fairley types still work there today. As of 2019, the railway is currently building a brand new one. Back in 1869, the railway had been seriously considering having to rebuild the line as double track due to the intensity of slate traffic. The use of double engines enabled them to run larger trains. One story that jumped out at me when reading up on this topic highlights the interrelationships between so many early engineers. Robert Francis Fairley's use of the Festiniog to test his locomotive was no accident. The railway was already a user of several tender locos built by George England, with whom Fairley had business relations. And Fairley had started to flirt with England's daughter Eliza, and he proposed, but George rejected it as Eliza was under 18 and he asked Fairley to wait. But the next year, Eliza and her sister took a trip to Crystal Palace, from where Eliza legged it to Spain, and she and Fairley eloped. George was, needless to say, not impressed. Fairley ended up in court on a charge of perjury, because he'd lied about having England's permission to get married. But here's where it all turns into a soap opera. During the trial, it transpired that Eliza's mother had been George's unmarried mistress at the time of her birth, and under the laws of the time, was not her legal father and therefore could not object to the marriage, and the case collapsed. Sounds like something you'd see on Jeremy Kyle or Jerry Springer. Fairley and England continued to work together, and Robert Francis Fairley took over England's business some years later. The success of Little Wonder led to 5 3-foot-6-inch gauge locos being built for the Imperial Livni Railway in Russia. These were a smash hit, and Fairley, emphasising that his articulated designs were what made narrow gauge worthwhile, published a book entitled Railways or No Railways, Narrow Gauge, Economy with Efficiency versus Broad Gauge, Costliness with Extravagance, leaving no one in any doubt as to his position. Bristol-based locomotive builders Avonside built many Fairleys for export, as well as the Festiniog's second double Fairley, named James Spooner. This loco corrected many of the faults that were present with Little Wonder. Little Wonder itself was only 2 years old when Avonside was building two locos for export to Canada. These were wood-burning machines, but perhaps highlighting the limited space available on board, all the wood for fuel had to be carried on top of the boilers. This meant that instead of a crew of two people, three had to be employed on each locomotive. The third man was known as the wood passer, and he had to ride on top of the loco in all weathers, passing wood down to the firemen. Several were built and exported to Russia and Mexico, and one example went to the USA. The Americans were not very impressed with their loco, named Mountaineer. It cost nearly three times as much as a conventional loco to build, and it consumed more than twice the amount of coal. Sadly, Mountaineer, like its Canadian brethren, scarcely lasted 10 years in service. An exception to the short-lived Fairleys were two that worked in Portugal. One of these was 70 years old when it was withdrawn in 1945. In Mexico, the double Fairley really came to its own. Tom Rolt, of Talican Railway fame, wrote that Three 12-wheeled Avonside Fairleys were built in 1871 to work traffic on the steeply graded section of the main line between Cordoba and the Boca del Monte summit in the Orizaba Mountains. So successful were they that they were the forerunners of no less than 50 Fairleys supplied to Mexico by Avonside and other British builders over a period of 40 years. Another user of Fairleys was the New Zealand Railway. One example, named Josephine, is preserved today on the South Island. A variant of the Fairley which did fare really well in New Zealand and the USA was the single Fairley. This got rid of the double-ended feature and had only one boiler and one power bogey, with a normal bunker at the back carried by an unpowered bogey. It looks almost like someone chopped a double Fairley in half. The first single Fairley was built for work in Ireland in the same year as Little Wonder was being put through its paces in Wales. This kept the flexibility of the double Fairley but increased the fuel capacity potential. The Festiniog has a single Fairley working today, and the original locomotive that this replica is based on, Taliesin, was said to have set the speed record for the downhill run on the Festiniog. The story goes that David Davies took an empty stock working from Gladnipur Junction to Boston Lodge, which is a distance of 12 miles. He's said to have left the top station at 4:30 p.m. and was pushing the carriages back into the shed before everybody clocked off for the day at 5 p.m. That implies an average speed of 24 miles per hour and a top speed of around 40. If you've ever travelled on the Festiniog Railway, which I highly recommend, the thought of doing 40 and even 24 through the sharp curves and along the sheer drops is terrifying, but oh my goodness, would I love to have been able to see that. The single Fairleys that were in use in New Zealand were built by the Avonside Engine Company in Bristol, Britain, and shipped over. There is one example of the NZR R-Class 064 preserved, which is hopefully to be restored to working order. This particular locomotive, R28, survived partially due to being involved in a crash. In 1907, it was bringing a train down to Littleton Harbour Station, failed to stop, smashed through the buffers, and nearly took a dive off the wharf into the harbour. The power bogey ripped off the locomotive and fell into the water, but the rear bogey and the superstructure remained dangling Italian job style over the edge. R28 was recovered, along with its power bogey, and like many of its class, was sold into industrial use in the 1930s, eventually ending up being taken out of service in about 1948. It spent some time on static display in a car park and was taken on by a preservation group in the year 2000. One of R28's sister engines, R271, did end up in the sea. When it was withdrawn in 1936, it was dumped in the foreshore at Oamaru. The remains have since been dragged out of the sea and are on display. What's left is the power bogey, consisting of the wheels, the frames and the cylinders, coated in the thickest layer of rust you've ever seen. The single Fairley was itself further developed into the Mason bogey type. William Mason was the Fairley patent holder in the United States. A preserved standard gauge Mason bogey holds the title of the oldest Fairley still in use. This loco, named Torch Lake, was built in 1873, only 4 years after the first Irish single Fairley. It started life as a narrow gauge loco and worked its whole life in Michigan. Still in service at over 90 years old, it was donated to the Henry Ford Museum in 1969, where today it hauls tourist trains. The fact that most of the locos described were built in such a short time frame is indicative of the way that the Fairley patent flared into the public eye, propelled by the relentless self-promotion of Robert, before the problems became evident with the design and it fell out of favour. In 1901, the Vulcan Foundry, and later the Yorkshire Engine Company, redesigned the double Fairley by splitting the boilers apart, creating a walk-through cab. Importantly, this meant that the fireboxes were easier to keep covered with water, which was a problem with the long boilers of the original locos. In France, the Fairley concept was adapted into the Peugeot-Bourdon design. This was during the great arms race that culminated in the First World War. And I say adapted, Peugeot and Bourdon effectively ripped off Fairley's patent, making a few tiny changes, and got their own patent just 2 years after Fairley died. Its purpose was to operate on the 600mm gauge artillery railways, serving French forts and field artillery. You've got to remember during this time that tractors and lorries pretty much didn't exist. They were still in their infancy. Most equipment and supplies had to be delivered by rail or by horse. The reason this design was chosen was the theory that if one half of the loco was put out of action due to enemy fire, the other half could continue to operate. The Peugeot-Bourdon design had only one steam dome in the middle of the loco. Most Fairleys had two steam domes, one on each boiler. The first Peugeot-Bourdons were built by Decoville in the late 1880s and 1890s. By 1906, 50 locos of this type were in service, with another 280 following during the war. This order was placed with the Baldwin Locomotive Works, who managed to build and deliver the first 100 locos just 2 months after the order was placed. Many Peugeot-Bourdons were still at work in the French forts at the outbreak of World War II. but following the fall of France, all but three were broken up for scrap. So far, we've talked about two pretty good designs, but neither one has really nailed the problem, as they've both brought almost as many problems as they solved. In a future episode, I'd like to highlight the later developments of articulated locos, the Malleys and the Garretts, which were some of the largest and most powerful steam locomotives ever built. On a final note, if you get the chance, look up a picture of Robert Francis Fairley. The man has some of the most impressive sideburns I have ever seen. I want to give a shout out to two amazing websites packed full of information. The first is the Industrial Railway Society, which has access to hundreds of back issues of articles. The second website is Festopedia, which is a veritable goldmine of facts and stories on the Festiniog and Welsh Highland Railways. If you're interested in these railways at all, this website is an absolute must. If you enjoy Railway Mania, then please do subscribe. We're also on Twitter, the handle is @RailwayManiaNet, as well as Facebook and Instagram. Thanks for listening.